to live among men seeing everyone as his brother, to view no one as his enemy. But his choice was made. He walked toward the Hagia Sophia to find Amal. He would do everything in his power to give Constantinople to Mehmed, to the true and only God, and let his own heart break or stop as it would after. 44. Early May.
The castle in Edirne was nicer, Petru said, looking dubiously at the whitewashed walls and plain stone floors of the dining hall.
There were pig pens in Edirne nicer than this castle, Lada said.
You are welcome to go back and live in one of them.
I like this castle, really,
Petru said, scrambling to repair the damage he feared he had done. Lada sighed and shook her head.
No one hates this castle more than I do, but this is the capital. So we live here now.
She sat back looking around the table. Nikolai, Petru, Stefan, Darciana, and Bogdan were with her. Lada had sent for Wana. If her old nurse was in charge of the kitchen, Lada knew she would be safe from any attempts to poison her food.
Has anyone checked the treasury yet? Do we even have a treasury?
Lada realized how little of the actual running of a castle she had witnessed as a child. Mehmed had a legion of men employed to keep charge of his empire's finances. Lada did not even know where her resources were physically located, or whether she had any.
I can hunt for treasure in the castle, Nikolai said.
Me too,
Petru sat up excited. Sometimes Lada forgot how young he was. How young she was, too. She felt it more now, in the 3 days since she had taken the throne. She had focused for so long on getting here that she was not quite sure what to do now that her only goal was behind her.
I doubt there is much to find, Darciana said. Would the previous prince have kept his family wealth here? Our boyer?
She turned her head to the side and spit.
And his family kept their wealth on their own land. The Dinesh was not always prince. His wealth would be held by his family.
You need taxes, Stefan said.
Lada noticed that his right hand and Darciana's left hand were not on the table. Were they holding hands beneath it?
You do need taxes, a man's voice said. And for that, you need boyers. And for that, you need me.
She looked up to see Toma beaming at her, his arms open wide as though expecting her to run to him. At his side was Wana, who shifted away from him with a look on her face like she smelled something foul. Bogdan stood and embraced his mother. She patted his arm, then looked Lada up and down. Nodding, she tightened the apron around her waist and walked toward the kitchen, muttering about getting things in shape. Lada was surprised at how relieved she was to have Wana here again. It felt right. Toma, on the other hand, he sat down in the chair Bogdan had vacated, the one to Lada's immediate right.
Why are you meeting in here?
He looked derisively around the room.
You should be holding court in the throne room, or your chambers. I looked for you there first.
Lada had been staying in the tiny barracks with her men. That felt more like home than this castle. I have not taken chambers yet.
You must, and stop sitting with your men like a commoner. They should be standing at the ready near the doors, not treated like advisers. Appearances matter, Lada.
Speaking of appearances, Nikolai interrupted.
Lada suspected, despite Toma's pronouncement, that her men were merely guards.
Why are you here?
Toma smiled, showing all his stained teeth.
Before I deliver the good news to Matthias, we need to discuss finances. Castles do not run themselves, I'm afraid, and we will have to extend quite a few favors to secure the loyalty of the remaining Dinesh boyers, after what you did to their prince.
Lada sighed, making herself listen as Toma instructed her. The last time she had been forced to sit through tedious instruction in Turgo Viste, at least she had been able to demand to learn outside. Now, she did not have even that luxury. The castle reminded Lada of a tomb, heavy stones waiting to claim her as they had her father before her. She did not want to live there. Already, she craved escape, thinking longingly of the mountain peak in Arjesh. But she was the prince, and the prince lived in the castle. She took her father's old rooms, throwing out everything that had belonged to the dead Dinesh. Some of it might have been left over from her father. She did not care either way. Darjeana took over after Lada had cleared the rooms, securing enough furnishings for them to feel livable. "Are you sure you do not want curtains?" she asked, hands on her hips, her belly jutting out. Lada stared thoughtfully at the empty space above the narrow window. "My brother and I once used a curtain rod to push an assassin off a balcony. Maybe we should add them. Well, I thought they might be pretty, but certainly they can double as weapons. You are very practical." Lada shook her head. "I hate this castle, and every room in it. I do not care what it looks like." Darjeana nodded, not asking any questions. Lada liked that about her. She asked questions when she needed to, and otherwise let memories lie where they would. Lada suspected it was because Darjeana was equally reticent to talk about her own past. She seemed quite content in the present. She had appointed herself Lada's personal maid, but, contrary to convention, she did not sleep in Lada's rooms. Judging by the new expression of bemused happiness on Stefan's formerly blank face, Lada knew where Darjeana had settled. Darjeana had decided what she wanted and had secured it, in spite of carrying another man's child, in spite of her circumstances, in spite of everything. Lada felt a pang of jealousy. To be able to want a man and claim him, heedless of anything else. She could have claimed Mahmed. She had claimed him, but it did not satisfy her. Why could Darjeana find happiness when Lada could not? No, that was wrong. Lada had decided what she wanted, and she had secured it. The throne was hers. Mahmed's face and the feeling of his hands on her body still haunted her, though. She wished she could carve out his memory with a knife, trace the lines of him that would not leave her, then cut them free. She would bleed, but she would not die. Still, he lingered in places no knife could ever reach. Darjeana gasped, bringing Lada back to the present. She was bent over, hands on her belly. "Are you ill?" Lada asked. "I think the baby is coming." Lada was struck with a terror deeper than any battlefield could have presented. The need to flee was overwhelming. "I will go get the nurse. Juana, I mean." Darjeana nodded, breathing deeply against some internal pain Lada did not want to imagine. The nurse was easy to find. After laughing at Lada's obvious horror, Juana escorted Darjeana to another room. Lada waited outside with Stefan, who paced with nerves as though the child were his. Lada wondered idly what they would do with the newborn bastard. That was none of her business, though. The hope on Stefan's face grew increasingly pained. It was obvious he loved Darjeana. Lada wondered what that must feel like, to know someone loved you enough to take everything you were. To wait. To hope. She wondered what it would feel like to be the person who loved that much, too. She found Bogdan and invited him to her bedroom, but it did nothing to take the ache away from the edges of her memory of Mahmed. After Bogdan wanted to linger, Lada dressed hurriedly and left her rooms. She did not have space in her heart for that. Not after last time. Not after loving Mahmed so much and being so deeply betrayed by him. No, Bogdan was safe. Bogdan was steady. And she did not and would never love Bogdan as she had Mahmed, which was both a relief and an agony. When Juana told her that Darjeana had safely delivered a little girl, Lada was unmoved. "They want to see you," the nurse said. Lada did not want to see them. But Stefan was one of her oldest and most trusted men. So she entered the room, ready for the scent of blood and sweat and fear. Instead, she found a cozy, warm space. Darjeana was curled in a nest of blankets, the babe at her breast. Stefan sat next to them, gazing in wonder at the tiny, mewling creature. Darjeana looked up, beaming. "Thank you," she said. Lara frowned.
For what?
For giving me a world where I can raise my daughter how I wish. For giving us this Valahia.
Lara felt something tender and sweet unfurling in her chest. It was a vulnerable feeling, a dangerous one. She cleared her throat.
Well, I guess I will have to find another maid.
Darciana laughed.
There is a boyar woman who has already hired me on as a wet nurse. It is amazing what they will pay for, but as soon as I am able, I will be back to fill your room with deadly curtains. You will help me, right, my little Lada?
The endearment was very confusing. Stefan smiled up at her, nodding toward the baby.
We wanted to give her a name of strength.
Lada's face flushed. She had to clear her throat again. She leaned closer, trying to see the little bundle.
Is she pretty?
Darciana held out the baby. Her face was red, squished and bruised from its violent entrance into the world. Dark hair sprouted from the top of her head, and one tiny fist was balled tightly and raised in the air. She was not pretty, but she screamed, and the sound was piercing and strong.
Do you want to hold her?
No, Lada put her arms behind her back, just in case Darciana and Stefan tried to force the baby on her. But Darciana seemed content to hold the baby herself. Lada tentatively smiled.
When she is old enough, I will give her a knife.
Darciana and Stefan both laughed, and though Lada had been serious, she laughed too. But watching the tiny life, she promised herself she would do exactly that for this little girl, and every other Valahian under her rule. She would make them strong.
45. May 28th to the 29th. The liturgy was punctuated by the ceaseless bombardment strikes. Radu wished they could have coordinated with Mahmed somehow, so that the distant sound and vibration of rock meeting stone could have matched up perfectly. As it was, the beats fell too soon or too late, a jarring mess guaranteeing no one could truly lose themselves to the worship service. But that was never a possibility anyway. Not tonight. For the first time since Constantine had attempted to unite the churches, the Hagia Sophia was lit up. All their angry clinging to dogma and notions of religious purity had been abandoned, and they appealed to every icon, every relic, every link to God they had. If the Hagia Sophia could save them, they were finally ready to try it. Outside the walls, the Ottoman camps were quiet. The bombardment had increased. Everything they had left behind flung at the city in anticipation of one final burst. Arrows came over the walls with scrawled warnings from sympathetic Christian soldiers. The end is coming. But they did not need the information written on arrows. It was already written in the massive stone cannonballs hitting the walls. In the day of rest and prayer, Mahmed had given his men. One last assault. One last chance to defend or attack, to stand or fall, to live or die. And so the people of the city came to church. The Hagia Sophia was packed, claustrophobic. People stood shoulder to shoulder. Radu breathed the same air as everyone around him. They exhaled terror and resignation, and he inhaled it until he could not catch his breath. He much preferred the Hagia Sophia, dark, with the sound of birds fluttering near the roof. That had felt closer to worship than this. Constantine stood at the front, looking upward as though he were already an icon himself. Nearby, Giustiniani stood, pale and sweating. He should have been sitting, but appearances were everything. He had been injured in the bombardment yesterday. The panic that spread through the city at the idea of losing him had been more dangerous than any cannon. And so, Giustiniani stood when he should have been resting, prayed when he should have been sleeping, all so the people could see their emperor and their military commander and have some semblance of hope. When the service ended, no one moved. Radu was desperate to get outside, to be away from all this. A hand tugged on his vest and he whirled around, ready to strike. He looked down into the eyes of the little heir, Manuel.
Where is my cousin? Manuel asked. Something in the way his lip trembled, but his chin stayed firm, stabbed Radu to the core. Manuel was expecting to hear that Cyprian was dead, and he was preparing himself not to cry over the news. Radu dropped into a crouch so he was face to face with the boy. Cyprian is resting at home. He was hit on the head with some rocks. But he will get better. Manuel let out a breath of relief, grinning to reveal his first few lost teeth.
He promised to take me fishing when the siege is over.
Well then, there you have it. He will heal quickly, because he would never break a promise like that. Manuel nodded, quick to accept comfort. He slipped his tiny hand into Radu's hand, anchoring Radu with the weight of his innocence. John and their nurse soon joined them, the older boy solemn and ashen-faced. He nodded to Radu, and Radu formally dipped his head.
You will protect us, he said.
Radu wanted to sink into the ground. John nodded again, and Radu realized the boy was reassuring himself.
The men in the walls will protect us.
Everyone turned, watching as Constantine, stately and regal, marched out of the church. As the door closed behind him, there was a whoosh of collectively held breaths released, along with wails and cries of despair. People scattered in every direction. Radu overheard snatches of plans to hide places that might be safe, cisterns underground that no Turk would think to look in. At least they knew the limits of their faith. Radu grabbed the nurse's arm as she tried to herd the boys away. Stay here, he said. She scowled in offense.
I am to take the boys back to the palace.
If the walls are breached, the palace will be the first place the soldiers go looking for loot. She lifted her nose defiantly in the air, as though Radu's dour prediction were foul to smell.
Those filthy Turks cannot come past the columns. The angel of the Lord will descend from heaven and drive them away with a flaming sword.
Radu held back an exasperated huff, though it cost him dearly. Instead, he smiled encouragingly. Yes, of course. Which is why you should stay here. The Hagia Sophia is farther in the city than the angel will let the Turks get, so you will be safest here. She frowned, weighing his words. And it will do the boys good to pray more. No Byzantine nurse could resist the lure of forcing her charges to pray. She took both boys' hands and marched back into the center of the Hagia Sophia. Radu wished he could do more, but he knew Mahmed would want the Hagia Sophia intact and would send soldiers to protect it if and when they breached the walls. It was safer than anywhere else in the city. He walked out the doors, breathing the evening air with relief. Another little hand tugged on his shirt. He glanced down to see Amal. Taking a coin, his last, he placed it in the boy's palm. Tell him to look to the gates at the palace wall. I will... Where is my nephew? Radu whirled around. Constantine stared wearily back at him. Radu stammered in surprise and guilt. He is resting. I think he will recover, but he is not fit to fight. He glanced to the side. Amal was gone. Constantine nodded, something like relief in his eyes. Take his place at my side, then. Radu was swept along with Constantine's party. Stuck in the middle next to Giestiniani, he was unable to slip free. This was not where he wanted to be tonight. He had planned to position himself at the circus gate, a small gate opening into Balhenae Palace. He needed to be there, but there was nothing he could do to get away without looking suspicious. Constantine led them through the city, past the inner wall and to the masses of soldiers clustered in front of the Lykos River section of the wall. It was here and at the Balhenae Palace section that their final stand would be made. The palace was visible in the distance. Nazira was there as planned, and he was stuck here. Constantine climbed onto a pile of rubble, looking out in the twilight over the heads of his men.
Do not fear the evil Turks!
His booming voice was punctuated by a distant impact.
Our superior armor will protect us. Our superior fighting will protect us. Our God will protect us. Their evil sultan started the war by breaking a treaty. He built a fortress on the Bosporus, on our land, all while pretending at peace. He looked on us with envy, lusting after the city of Constantine the Great, your homeland, the true homeland of all Christians and the protection of all Greeks. He has seen the glory of our God and wants it for himself. Will we let him take our city?
The men shouted no angrily.
Will we let the call to prayer corrupt the air good Christians have breathed for more than 1,000 years? Another roar, even louder. Will we let them rape our women, murder our children and elders, and profane the sacred temples of God by turning them into stables for their horses?
This time, the roar of anger was accompanied by the slamming of spear butts into the ground and the pounding of fists on shields. Radu could not point out that it had been a Christian crusade 200 years before that had been guilty of all the above. Constantine continued on.
Today is your day of triumph. If you shed even one drop of blood, you will prepare for yourself a martyr's crown and immortal glory.
He raised a fist in the air.
With God's help, we will gain the victory. We will slaughter the infidels. We will bear the standard of Christ and earn our eternal rewards.
The sound of the cheering and screaming was almost enough to drown out the bombardment. Constantine held his arms in the air, then lowered them and turned. His face was haggard and drawn, losing light as quickly as the day turned to night around them.
We lock the gates back into the city, he said quietly to Giustiniani. We stand or fall where we are. No one gets out. If the wall falls, we all die together.
Giustiniani nodded grimly. Radu watched the two men with a disconnected sense of farewell. In his time here, he had seen them be truly great, holding together a city against impossible odds, and he had seen them commit atrocities while doing it. He respected them, and he hated them, and he knew the world would be lesser for their deaths. If they died, he both hoped for and dreaded that outcome, impossible to reconcile, just like everything else in this accursed city. He took a place on the wall next to Giustiniani. Although it was night, the Ottomans had lit so many fires the light bounced off the low clouds, creating an ominous orange haze everywhere. The defenders could not repair the walls because there was no cover of darkness. From his vantage point, Radu could see the mustering area for the Ottoman troops. Somewhere nearby, Mehmed waited to find out whether his grand design would succeed or fail, whether he would fill the prophecies of generations. Maybe if Radu were out there with Mehmed, this would have all been exciting. It made him ill to think of it, to imagine who he could have been, how easily he could have wanted the end of this city, and everyone in it. It also filled him with longing, knowing it could have been simple. But he released that thought to the night, too, along with everything else. He would die on the wall tonight, between his brothers and his enemies, because he could no longer distinguish between the two. They had finally come to the end. Whichever side won, neither would triumph. A stone cannonball slammed into the wall beneath Radu and Giustiniani. They fell to their knees, the impact jarring Radu from his toes to his teeth. He shook his head, trying to clear the strange ringing noise in his ears. No, not ringing. Screaming. He looked up past the defensive barrels to see a shouting horde rushing toward them. There was no order or sense to the approach. They ran like a swarm of locusts, over each other, pushing and shoving, each trying to get there first. Those that did were cut down, but it did not matter. The ones behind them climbed over the bodies. When they, too, were killed by arrows, their bodies added to the pile. Radu shot into the melee, watching in disgusted horror as the irregular forces of Mehmed's army used the corpses, and sometimes the living injured, as steps.
They clawed over each other, death itself a tool to crest the wall. There were so many men that Radu could not help but hit someone with every arrow he fired. It was as effective as shooting at waves of the sea. The men never stopped coming. Giestinjani directed his own forces, anticipating whenever a group of irregulars would breach the wall.
There!
He shouted, pointing toward a stretch not far from Radu. Radu ran toward it, watching as the first two soldiers clawed and tumbled their way on top. There were not enough men behind Radu. He had gotten there too fast. He hacked and slashed and blocked, but there was no hope. A man screaming in Valachian barreled into him, tripping him. Radu fell flat on his back, looking up into the face of death. No matter where he went, his childhood followed. And now he would kill him. Then the man was gone, except for his torso, which fell across Radu's feet. Radu blinked away the dust and smoke. All the irregulars who had breached the wall had been cut down by one of their own cannonballs. Radu kicked the man's body away, laying his head back onto the wall and laughing. Obana and her cannons had saved his life after all. He pushed himself up, rushing to Giestinjani. He was certain that he had been fated to die just then, but he was still here, which meant he could still accomplish something. This time, if an opportunity presented itself, he would not falter. Much farther along the wall, Constantine threw a man over the side. He pointed, and a spray of Greek fire lit up the night, burning the bodies of the living and the dead against the wall. The Greek fire moved up and down, consuming everything that wasn't stone. Men ran screaming, the attack's momentum gone.
"They are retreating!" Giestinjani roared.
The men around Radu cheered, some crying and some praying. Between Constantine and Giestinjani, the city still stood a chance. Giestinjani clapped Radu on the shoulder.
"You made it! I am glad!"
They ducked as a cannonball whistled overhead, falling somewhere in the space between the two walls.
"Do you think we have them on the run? They were intended to wear us down. Next he will send Janicheris."
Mahmed would have saved his best men for last, and Radu knew without question that the next wave really would be the last. If numbers could not overwhelm the wall, only the Janicheris stood a chance. And if they could not win, Mahmed was finished. He had nothing left to throw at them.
"We can hold! We will hold!"
Giestinjani favored his wounded leg as he limped toward a ladder.
"Get something to drink and eat. You men, pick up the wounded. Take them to rest against the inner wall. We will shift positions to compensate, then..."
Everyone stopped as the music started. Radu watched as faces of weary happiness shifted into exhausted terror. They would have no break tonight. The meter music of the Janicheris crashed against the wall with as much force and intimidation as any bombardment. The white flaps of their caps glowed like skulls in the firelight as they rushed, screaming, toward the wall. This was it. This last wave would overcome the wall and flood the city, or it would recede, taking Mahmed's chances with it. Mahmed himself rode back and forth, just out of crossbow range. Radu could see him, would have known him anywhere. But his heart did not sing, did not yearn for him. So little land separated them, but that distance was soaked in blood and lit by flames. Giestinjani shouted for Radu,
"Cut the ropes! Throw down the hooks!"
Radu ran back and forth, hacking at ropes, dislodging hooks. Every man under Giestinjani followed his commands without hesitation or question. Radu could not see or hear Constantine, but he was certain that section of the wall was the same. Two men to hold back an empire. Radu stopped, sitting with his back against a barrel and watching. All the men around him were Italians, Giestinjani's men. They were as good as the Janicheris, and they had the high ground. What could he do? Even if he stopped helping, stopped throwing down hooks and ropes, he would do nothing to turn the tide. A man jumped over the wall next to Radu. Radu looked up at him in surprise.
seeing the Tsar's face under the Yanacheri cap. No, the Tsar was dead. Radu had killed him to save Mahmed. Radu pushed himself up, stabbing the Yanacheri and letting his body fall. But there were more. Yanacheris leapt over this section of the wall, led by a giant of a man. He towered over everyone, the white of his cap gleaming above the mass of bodies. He held a broadsword, unusual for an Ottoman, but fitting for his size. The man swung the sword from side to side, cutting down everyone who came at him with eerily silent efficiency. Protected by his fury, more and more Yanacheris climbed onto the wall. "With me!" Giestinyani slashed his way through to the giant. Radu followed in his wake, protecting his back. Not even Giestinyani could take the giant in hand-to-hand combat, though. As he got close, the man swung his sword. At the last moment, Giestinyani dropped to his knees. He swung his own sword with all the strength he had in him. The giant stopped, looking down in surprise. Then he slid to the ground, both his legs cut off at the knees. The Yanacheris around them stopped in shock. Giestinyani stood, raising his sword in triumph. And this time, when he knew what Larda would do, Radu did not hesitate. He swept his sword across the backs of Giestinyani's legs, straight through the muscles and tendons, one swift cut to turn the tide. Giestinyani fell. Radu caught him. "Giestinyani!" he shouted. "He is wounded! Help!" The Italian's men rushed to them with all the energy they had left. The Yanacheris remaining on the wall were quickly overwhelmed. "What should we do?" one of the Italian soldiers asked, tears streaming down his face as he looked at the man he had followed in defense of a foreign city. "We have to get him to the boats," Radu stood, grasping Giestinyani under the arms. "No," Giestinyani moaned, shaking his head. He was white with shock and blood loss, eyes wild. "We cannot open the gate. We have to save him." Radu nodded to the crying soldier, who carefully took Giestinyani's ruined legs. They maneuvered him down from the wall with the help of the rest of the Italians, passing him from one man to the other. Giestinyani groaned and cried out in pain, all the while telling them to stop. They rushed across the open stretch, dodging arrows and cannonballs. All the Italians had followed. More than 100 men this section of the wall could not afford to lose. "The key!" Radu shouted. "Who has the key?"
"Giestinyani does,"
Radu heard shouting over everything else. On top of the wall, Constantine stood gesturing. He was frantic, waving his hands and shaking his head. If that gate opened and men went through, it would be a mortal wound to the city. Too many would choose to flee if given the option. Men ran toward them to stop them, swords drawn.
"If they keep us here, Giestinyani will die," Radu shouted.
The Italians, ever loyal to Giestinyani, drew their swords against the soldiers they had fought shoulder to shoulder with all these long weeks. Everyone stopped, waiting to see what would happen. Radu reached into Giestinyani's blood-spattered vest and pulled out a heavy iron key. Giestinyani grabbed his hand.
"Please," he said.
His face was pale and bathed in sweat, but his eyes were lucid.
"Do not do this."
Radu looked up at the wall. Constantine stood silhouetted against the glowing night sky. His shoulders drooped. Then he took off his cloak, throwing it off the wall. His helmet, with a metal circlet on it, followed. He turned and joined the fight at the wall as one of the men he had lived with, as one of the men he would die with.
"It is the only thing I can do," Radu whispered.
He tugged his hand free, then opened the gate. As soon as he was through, he ran toward Balhenae Palace. If any of Giestinyani's men noticed he did not stay with them, they were too busy saving themselves to stop him. There were not many men left at the palace, just a handful to guard the circus gate, and, in a stroke of luck or providence, they were all Italians.
"Giestinyani has been wounded," Radu shouted. "His only chance is to get to the boats. They need your help."
The men stood still for a few seconds, then ran. The gate was his alone,
Radu walked to it, his feet dragging. The bar across the door carried the weight of 1,000 betrayals. He managed to lift it and left the door open. He had chosen this one because it was the most poorly guarded, but it was not big enough to let a whole army in. He needed something more. If anyone could still claim victory in the midst of this, it was Constantine. Radu needed to break the defenders' spirits. If he did, the city would fall. He climbed back along the wall to the palace itself, where Nazira was waiting with a cloth-wrapped bundle. She threw her arms around him, pressing her face into his shoulder.
I feared you were dead.
Not yet. He pulled out the Ottoman flags they had stolen from Orhan's tower. They ran through the echoing palace, climbing and climbing until they reached the top. From there, they heard the sounds of dying, the clash of metal, the screams of fury. They tore down the emperor's flag, and in its place they hung the flag of the Ottoman Empire. Splitting up, they found every place they could hang a flag where the combatants would see it. Finally, meeting back on the wall above the gate that Radu had left open, he waved the last flag he had before draping it over the wall above the way in. He looked then at where Constantine stood between his city and destruction. Though it was too dark and Radu knew it was not possible, he felt as though they locked eyes one last time. A cry went up among the men. The desperate push at the gate to the city intensified. They thought the Ottomans were inside and would abandon all to go save their families or die alongside them. Radu turned away. He had done his part. The pendulum had swung in Mehmed's favor, and would never return to the defenders. He had managed to kill Constantine, after all, but too late to be merciful to any of them.
What now?
Nazira whispered. Cyprian, Radu said. They clasped hands and ran from the palace into the dark city, racing against the coming flood.
46. Mid-May. The body of Larda's brother, Machia, rotted in a shallow grave a short ride from Turgoviste. He had been heading for Snagov, the monastery island where their father had once taken them. He had not ridden fast or far enough to find sanctuary. Where he lay, the earth was nearly indistinguishable from that around it. Larda had only found his body because one of the soldiers who had run him down was now hers. Ah, the loyalty of men. She dismounted and kicked idly at the finally thawed ground. The morning mist had settled in the depression, softening everything. It was a beautiful morning, damp, with the slow promise of heat on the way. Petru and Bogdan stayed on their horses, scanning the field and distant trees for threats. Larda was prince now, which made her an even bigger target. But this was something she had felt she needed to do. She could not share her victory with the brother she loved, so she would resolve the fate of the one she had hated. Now that she was here, she did not know what she had expected to accomplish. Rebury him? Bring his remains back to the castle? Say a prayer over his body, one that might as well be blasphemy for all the sincerity it held? She finally had to admit that she had seized on this adventure mainly as a way of escaping the city. Toma had been pestering her, wanting to talk about various Dinesh boyars and their loyalties. How to gain them, why she needed them, what marriages might cement them. The other boyar lines were not thrilled with her ascension, but they would not object as long as they profited. The Dinesh lines took it personally, though. Toma never passed up an opportunity to circle back to the subject of marriage with the Dinesh, dangling the possibility in front of Larda with all the subtlety of a noose. Finally, she had told him she would meet with every Dinesh boyar at the same time, and left him to plan it for her. She was certain his letter-writing skills far surpassed her own. He would know what to say to get the boyars to come. Her idea had been to tell them to come or forfeit their land and their lives. Toma had laughed like she had made a wonderful joke. At least Machir was dead, and she did not have to listen to him. That made him preferable to Toma. How did he die?
she asked. He died well, the soldier said, voice tight as he stared straight ahead. Larda snorted. You are a liar. My brother was a bully and a coward. He would not have died well. He would have died fighting or begging for his life. Which was it? The soldier shifted uncomfortably. He died fighting. If he died fighting, why did you not say that to begin with? The soldier swallowed, saying nothing further. Dig him up! The man finally met her eyes, horror shifting his dull expression into something childlike. But dig him up! The man looked from the grave to Larda, then back again. But we have no shovels, no tools.
Larda reached into her saddlebag and pulled out a hard loaf of bread. She broke off pieces and passed them to Bogdan and Petru. They dismounted and dragged an old stump over for Larda to sit on. She made herself comfortable. The soldier still stared dumbly. Larda pulled out a knife, setting it on the stump.
You have your hands, for now.
The man began digging.
The sun was directly overhead by the time he finished. His fingernails bled, and he cradled his hands to his chest as he backed away from the body he had unearthed. Larda held her cloak over her nose. It would have been better had she taken the throne in the winter. It was warm enough now for her to smell him. But that was not the troubling part. Her brother, Machir the cruel, Machir the hated, Machir the dead, did not stare up at her with the accusing eyes of the dead. He did not stare up at all. She was looking at the back of his head. Turn him over, she said. Gagging, the soldier reached into the grave and maneuvered the corpse so it was face up. Machir's skin was waxy and thin, where it had not been eaten away to the bone. His fingers, too, looked like the soldier's, nails broken and caked with dirt. Machir's mouth was open in a scream, black with rot. Larda leaned closer. No, it was black with dirt, all the way down as far as she could see. You buried him alive, she said. The soldier shook his head frantically. I had nothing to do with it. It was Hunyadi's men and the Dinesh prince.
But you were there.
The man shook his head, then nodded, foolish tears of desperation leaking from his eyes. But I did not kill him. Larda sighed, kicking the corpse of her brother back over so he could not see her. It was a terrible way to die. She imagined him twisting and turning, the weight of dirt suffocating him as he grew more and more disoriented. In the end, he had been clawing deeper into the earth, instead of toward the sun and freedom. She wondered how her father had died. No one in Turgoviste knew where he had been killed, or, if they did, they were smart enough to say nothing. And she wondered about her own loyalty and disloyalty to Hunyadi, the man who had helped the Dinesh Boyars kill both her brother and father, the Boyars whose support she was still courting. Guilt and regret warred with resigned exhaustion. She did not know how to feel about this. Why could she have no easy relationships? Why was there no man in her life she could feel only one way about? I did not kill him. I did not kill him, the soldier whispered, chant-like, as he rocked back and forth. Larda did know how to feel about the soldier. She latched onto it with a startling ferocity. It offered her a lifeline, something solid and secure to react against. I do not care if you killed him. He is dead. That problem is past us. The soldier slumped in relief. Thank you, my lady. Larda sheathed her knife. I am not your lady. I am your prince. And while the death of Machir is not our problem, your lying to me is. The soldier looked up, fear curling his lips to reveal his teeth sticking out just like those in Machir's agonized skull. Bogdan! A rope! Bogdan took a rope out of his saddlebag. Larda tied it tightly around the soldier's wrists. She tossed the free end to Petru. He nodded grimly, then tied it to his saddle. What are you going to do to me? The soldier asked through clattering teeth. We are taking you back to Turgoviste as an example of what happens to those who do not honor the truth. What if he cannot keep up with the horses? Petru asked.
Lada looked at the open grave of her brother, where his corpse once again faced the dirt that had claimed him.
That is what the rope is for. She spurred her horse forward, going too fast for any man to run long enough to keep from being dragged to his death. She did not look back.
47. May 29th. Dawn came at last. Birds circled overhead, dark silhouettes against the sky, drawn by the carnage beneath. Soon, they would descend. Nazira and Radu ran as quickly as they could. The streets had filled with groups of citizens, clustered together and panicking.
"Is it true?" a man shouted as they sprinted past. "Are they in the city?"
"Run!" Nazira screamed. The man dropped to his knees and began praying instead. Behind them, they heard the sounds of conflict drawing closer. There were no Byzantine soldiers in the city. No one left to fight. But the Ottomans, surging over the wall, did not know that. They would come ready to fight in the streets, and when they realized there was no one left to bar their way.
"We have to get Cyprian out," Radu said, gasping for air. "Valentin, too."
"How?"
The way to Galata would be closed. The Ottomans would anticipate that. The bells on the sea wall began clanging a warning. If the Ottoman soldiers in the galleys knew the city had been taken, they would be eager to join the pillaging. The sea walls were barely manned now, and with word spreading through the city that the walls had fallen, everyone would abandon their posts, leaving the sailors free to climb over. No one wanted to miss out on the looting. Nothing was off limits. Gold, jewelry, people, anything that could be moved and sold would be. But if the sea walls were not manned, and all the sailors rushed into the city...
"The horn!" Radu said. "We make for the horn. There are still the Italian ships. We may even be able to steal one of the Ottoman galleys."
"Are you certain we will meet no resistance?" Nazira asked.
Radu could not be certain of anything.
"It is our best chance."
"What about Mehmed? You could ride out to meet him."
They collapsed against Cyprian's door. His home was deep enough in the city that no sounds of fighting had reached it yet.
"I will not leave you and Cyprian here. Not for anything," Radu said. "I can come back when the 3 days of looting are over and everything has settled."
Nazira squeezed his hand. Then they ran into the house.
"Valentin!"
Nazira shouted. The boy rushed down the stairs, nearly falling.
"We heard the bells. Cyprian is getting dressed to fight. I told him not to, but..."
Nazira handed Valentin his cloak.
"The city is falling. We are running."
Radu looked up to see Cyprian standing at the top of the stairs. His injury had left him unable to get out of bed for more than a few minutes at a time without becoming dizzy. He was as pale and bleak as the dawn.
"My uncle?"
Radu shook his head.
"It is over. If we do not run now, we will not get out alive."
Cyprian closed his eyes, taking a deep breath. Then he nodded, resolve hardening all his features.
"Where do we go?"
"The horn."
Radu turned to leave, then paused.
"Wait!"
He sprinted up the stairs, throwing open the chest in the room he had shared with Nazira. At the bottom, carefully folded, were the clothes they had worn on their journey to Constantinople. Radu yanked his robes on over what he already wore, then hastily wrapped a turban around his hair. Better to look like friend than foe to the invading army. Cyprian nodded.
"Like the flags," he said.
For a terrible moment, Radu thought Cyprian knew what they had done at the palace, but then he remembered the flags on the boats to help them sneak past the Ottoman fleet.
"Yes. Speak in Turkish," Radu cautioned. "Valentin, you say nothing."
The four of them paused on the threshold of the house. They had been happy here, after a manner. As much happiness as could be found in the slow, agonizing death of a city falling around them. Then... they ran. Cyprian was in the lead, taking them on a winding route around the edges of the city, skirting populated areas in favor of abandoned ones. They were nearly to a gate on the sea wall when they came across the first group of Ottoman soldiers. A clump of citizens had been caught in the alley, and the soldiers ran at them, screaming and brandishing swords. Half of the group had been cut down before the soldiers realized there was no resistance and stopped. Radu thought nothing could be more horrifying than watching unarmed people hewn down. Until the soldiers began claiming them, one young woman, her clothes already torn, was being tugged between two men.
"I had her first," one shouted. "She is mine! Find your own!" "There will be plenty," their commander said, going through the bags of the dead.
He did not even look at the girl as the soldiers pulled off what remained of her clothes, arguing over who could keep her and how much she would be worth. The girl stared at Radu, her eyes already blank and dead, though she still lived. If Radu were truly good, if he were not a coward, if he valued all life the same, he would risk drawing the soldiers' attention and kill her right now. But he had to save Nazira, and he had to save Cyprian. "Come on," Radu whispered. They slipped back the way they had come. At a gate to the thin shore of the Horn, two remaining Greek soldiers huddled, debating whether or not to open it. Cyprian stalked up without pausing.
"They are already in the city," he said.
"We will drive them out."
A small soldier, barely past his youth, stood in Cyprian's way.
"The angel will come. We must hold them off until then."
"Does he have the key?"
Cyprian asked the lanky soldier next to the boy. He nodded. Cyprian punched the boy in the face, then pulled the key from his vest.
"The city has fallen. Do what you see best."
Crying, the young soldier stumbled away. The lanky soldier slipped out the gate as soon as Cyprian unlocked it. They followed him onto a narrow stretch of rocky beach lining the sea wall. No boats were docked here. The Venetian boats had not fled yet, but from the movement on board, they would soon. And, just as Radu had predicted, several Ottoman galleys were drifting not far from shore, completely abandoned. Someone had dumped logs into the water, where they floated by the hundreds, bobbing gently on the waves. No, not logs. Radu watched as a man who had managed to swim as far as the Venetian ships attempted to climb up the side. A sailor on the deck reached down with a long pole, pushing him off into the water.
Why not help him?
Nazira whispered, her hands covering her mouth. Cyprian leaned back against the wall, the hollows beneath his eyes nearly as grey as his irises.
They fear being swamped. There are too many people trying to get on the boats.
Valentin shook his head in disbelief.
All these people. They could have saved them.
Many of the bodies in the water had wounds no pole could cause, though. The Ottomans must have gotten here at the same time as those people who had figured out the Horn was a means of escape. The delay to get Cyprian and Valentin had likely saved all their lives.
"What do we do?" Nazira asked, turning to Radu.
"Can you swim?"
"A little."
He looked at Cyprian, who nodded. Valentin nodded too, eyeing the corpse-strewn water with resigned weariness that had no place on such a young face.
"The smallest galley. We can row it out until we catch the wind. Once we have that in our sails, we can slip down and away."
"And then?"
Cyprian asked. "And then we keep going."
The bells of the Hagia Sophia, deeper and older than any others in the city, began clanging. Radu bade the church a silent farewell. Valentin slipped his hand into Radu's. And Radu remembered two young boys, still in the church, where he had left them.
"You will protect us," John had said.
Radu looked at Nazira and Valentin and Cyprian, and he knew then that the scales would never be back in his favor. But he could do this one thing. He could die trying to save two boys who meant nothing to him, who meant everything to him.
"I am staying," Radu said.
"What? No!"
Nazira grabbed his free hand, tugging him toward the water.
"We need to leave now."
"I have to go back."
her full lips trembling, Nazira nodded.
Fine. We go back.
Radu kissed her hand, then held it out to Cyprian.
No woman is safe in the city. Not today, not for the next 3 days. I cannot let anything happen to you. I promised Fatima. You have to go home.
Nazira stamped her foot, tears streaming down her face.
We have to go home together.
You cannot go back in.
Cyprian stepped past Nazira. He ignored her hand and grabbed Radu's, the intensity of his gaze overwhelming.
You will die. I know where John and Manuel are. I can save them.
Cyprian looked as though he had been struck. He closed his eyes, then stepped even closer, pressing his forehead to Radu's.
Their fate is in God's hands now. It was never in God's hands. No, it was in my uncle's, damn him, and his pride. He has killed them, not you. Not us. If you stay, Mahmed will find you, and he will kill you.
Radu's final punishment was announced by a new bell pealing nearby, harsh and unyielding. He would not be allowed any mercy for the things he had done. He could not escape, and he could not keep anything he hoped to. Radu shifted his face, resting his cheek against Cyprian's for the space of one eternally breaking heartbeat.
He will not kill me,
Radu whispered. Then he pulled back, forcing himself to look Cyprian in the eyes. Those eyes that had caught his attention even when Mahmed was his whole world. Those eyes that had somehow become the foundation of a hope that maybe, someday, Radu could have love.
He will not kill me,
Radu repeated, waiting for Cyprian to understand. The foundation in Cyprian's eyes crumbled like the walls around them. Cyprian stumbled back, shaking his head.
All this time,
he whispered.
Will you still keep her safe? Radu asked.
Cyprian stared at the rocks beneath them, as mute and stunned as he had been when lightning nearly killed him.
You could have escaped, he finally whispered. You did not have to tell me. I would have. We could have. We could have been happy. We could have, he asked.
Radu knew what Cyprian was asking, and if he had not already lost all hope, it would have ended him.
I do not deserve happiness.
The bells of the Hagia Sophia rang out more insistently.
John and Manuel are running out of time. Will you still keep Nazira safe?
A single tear ran down Cyprian's face. He did not look at Radu, but he nodded.
I will, he said.
This one good thing, then, Radu had managed to do. He had not broken all his promises. Nazira threw herself forward, hugging him fiercely.
You come back to us,
she hissed in his ear.
Be safe,
he answered. Then, his heart breaking, all the more for knowing that he could trust Cyprian even now. Radu fled back into the city. The street was slick beneath Radu's boots. He slipped going down on his hands and knees. When he rose again, his hands were bloody. He had not felt them get cut, had not thought he had fallen hard. Then he realized that the blood was not a result of his fall, but rather the cause of it. The streets ran with it. And so he, too, ran. He ran past soldiers, throwing everything portable out of houses. He ran past women and children being dragged screaming from hiding places. He ran, and he ran, and he ran. He tried his best not to look, but he knew that what he saw that day would be seared in his memory. Today, he saw the true cost of two men's immovable wills. He saw what happened when men were forced to fight each other for months on end. It was not merely sickness of the body that plagued sieges, but sickness of the soul that turned men into monsters.
Radu was nearly at the Hagia Sophia when he saw a boy thrown to the ground. A soldier flipped the boy onto his back, reaching down to undo his trousers. Radu slit the soldier's throat from behind.